Are you an entrepreneur looking for more free time, more money, or just looking for that success blueprint? The Proven Entrepreneur is the podcast for you. Host Don Williams and his guests share real success stories from proven entrepreneurs. Here's your host, Don Williams.
Hey, Don Williams here with today's episode of the Proven Entrepreneur Show. I have a great guest today, owner of a great company that many entrepreneurs will need help from his or a similar company at some point in their life. Today, we welcome Ben Golden with IRS Trouble Solvers. Ben, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me today, Don. I really appreciate it.
Well, I'm grateful to have you, and taxes. And what is it? Death and taxes are two inescapable facts of life. And one thing with taxes may be trouble at some point. If you are in business long enough and you do enough business, probably one day you are in some degree of trouble. And a trouble solver is a good thing to have. So we'll talk more about that here in a minute. So, Ben, how long have you been in business at IRS Trouble Solvers?
So I've been doing taxes and accounting for 20 plus years. I opened this company about 6 years ago now, 5 years ago. And our specific goal is to help people that have problems with the IRS that they cannot deal with themselves.
Ah, very good. And I would say I'm a 36-year entrepreneur, founded a dozen companies, principal in five companies today. I've done a lot of tax return. Had a lot of tax activity between me and the federal government. And I'm a big believer in that unless it's really minor, you should get an expert to help you, somebody who knows what's going on.
Absolutely. That's one of the problems that a lot of people find themselves in. And I've seen it many a times. Somebody thinks that they don't have a difficult tax return and they go and use some software they can get off the internet to prepare their tax return. I had one gentleman that I helped, and I couldn't really help him a whole lot because when I looked at his return, he put the same automobile in for the same number of mileage four times using one of these do-it-yourself softwares. And I was like, look, this is just, it's just wrong.
It's just wrong.
So let's just get it to where it's right. You know, when we defend people in audits, we just want the correct tax to be paid and then the least amount of penalties that they can pay as well, depending on the issues, of course. You know, sometimes you do owe it, and so we get them into a payment plan or figure out what we have to do there. But I'll tell you, sometimes it can be a challenge.
Yeah. Well, and a word to the wise to our listeners today is this: don't ignore problems. They just get worse.
I completely agree with that, Don. I'm a big statistics person. An accountant, you probably didn't figure that, right? So 93% of all audits that the IRS has, they have a change. Okay. Of those 93%, 67% are because the people do not answer the mail from the IRS. So they don't even open it up. They see that it's from the IRS. They see that it's from the state. And it's like fear just strikes them all over and they become paralyzed and they cannot get that letter opener into that envelope. So you are 100% right. Do not procrastinate and absolutely do not let fear paralyze you and just throw the envelope into the desk drawer and hope it goes away, because it will never go away on its own.
It will not go away. Yeah. And it's so crazy. You know, so just during the pandemic, you know, the IRS, you know, with the PPP and ERC and EIDL and all these programs, and then kind of temporary moving of deadlines and temporary stuff. And I know with our own business interests, we got some penalties that, and I think some of them were specific to Texas returns. And so, you know, we got some penalties and our tax pro's like, hey, go ahead and pay them and we'll work it out later. But, you know, it doesn't work to not pay them. And about, I don't know, 8 weeks later, you know, the IRS just refunded it all. So it's like, okay, this is crazy, but
8 weeks, you got lucky. Normally it's 8 months.
Yeah, this was probably 8 weeks. But if you're a new entrepreneur, all of that sounds a little nonsensical. That's the way it is. And so get somebody to help you. Okay. So, all right, let's hop back out of today, the present, and let's go to the past. And so I'm going to take you all the way back to young Ben. So 5 years old to 18. Okay. And the first question I want to ask you is this. So during that time frame, the household or households that you were raised, and that's different for a lot of different people, mom or dad or both or grandparents or whatever, don't care about that. But was any adult in your childhood an entrepreneur?
Absolutely. Yes.
Okay. Who was?
My father.
Your father. And will you tell us a little bit about what type of entrepreneur he was?
Absolutely. So in 1980, he started his own railroad construction business, and I grew up around it. And when I turned 18, I went into the paper mills and worked with the railroad on industrial lines, and I got to learn and understand everything railroad. So I grew up on a farm as well. So a lot of the people that I went to school with, college, they had never seen hard manual labor. You know, I was a pick and shovel man. And dad, you know, grew it from $140 and a dream in his pocket, you know, $140 in his pocket and a dream to, you know, a massive multi-million dollar company. And quite blessed, quite well.
I love that. And so there are certain industries that there are really no little companies. And if they're in timber or mining or railroads, there's just, you know, I live outside of Fort Worth, Texas. We have a little railroad company here by the name of Burlington Northern Transport. I don't know. I don't know, 50% of all rail freight or something.
Right.
I think that guy in Nebraska is a Berkshire Hathaway company. And growing up in rural Kansas, I had a friend who worked for, at that time, the Frisco Railroad, which is probably part of Burlington Northern now. I don't think it exists, but okay. So you come by entrepreneurship, honestly. And you know, what I've found in doing the show is only about half the people had an entrepreneurial example. The other half, they were just wired to where they weren't going to be able to be a W-2 person all their life. And so let's stay with young Ben. Okay. So what was your first job, and it might have been a lemonade stand, might have been your first company. What was the first thing you did where you earned compensation, and how old were you?
Yeah, I was 8 years old, and my dad paid me a quarter an hour to work on the farm.
Oh, there. I love that. Yeah. So I drove a John Deere tractor behind the combines at wheat harvest, which is a filthy, nasty, dirty job. Because literally you're in the field like 15 minutes after. So there's still dust and chaff and all that. And it's like 100 and a lot degrees in Kansas in June. But I tell people that, and they're like, well, how old were you? And I was like, well, now you couldn't do this today, probably. But it was my grandparents. So it was their farm. And I was 11. And maybe the more telling fact was this: I drove the pickup from the house to the farm to get on the tractor, and that was 9 miles, and I was 11.
Yeah, I mean, same story there. I was in charge of a 72 horse tractor. Dad put it in granny gear, and he said, "Don't change the gears." I was bush hogging the pasture, and what's the worst that could happen? You know, I'd run off in a ditch or something like that, I guess, but that's pretty much what I did, was build fences and a helper and run the tractor. I didn't know anything else. I thought that's the way all kids grew up. I didn't know.
Yeah. Well, very first day going into the very first field from the lot, I clipped the gate post with the disc and pulled down about, I don't know, it seemed like hundreds, but it wasn't. It was, you know, probably 10 or 15. And so my first day I spent resetting fence posts and restringing barbed wire. So the positive in all that is both of us learned what hard work is, and that will take you a long way in entrepreneurship, is just get in there and work hard. So anyhow, after young Ben in your folks' house, you graduated high school, you backpacked across Africa, or you joined the Merchant Marines, or you joined the Marines, or you went to college. What's your story? What'd you do next?
So when I was young, I always wanted to be an accountant. I don't know why. I told my dad when I was like 10, I was like, look, I'm going to college. Save some money. So I wanted to be an accountant. I enjoy the financial side of the world. And so I went to the University of Alabama and graduated with an accounting degree. And my wife, we got married and she was in the Air Force. So we went and she was stationed at Travis Air Force Base in Fairfield, California, which is just outside of San Francisco.
Which is nowhere near the University of Alabama.
It's a little far away. And so that gave me the opportunity to get my master's degree in taxation. Then after that, I was able to start running down the road of taxes. And I found out in the accounting world, taxes is that's sort of where I gravitated towards and enjoyed.
Yeah. Love that. I don't understand it, but I love that. Yeah. Right. And I just say that because I come from the top salesman in the country at 19, top sales manager at 20. When I opened my first company and it came time for my first corporate return, I could not spell P&L, and there's only two letters in P&L. And I was woefully uneducated, but you know, education can be had. It's just expensive. And it depends on when you pay for it. Yeah. Okay. So is your first entrepreneurial company an accounting firm, tax practice, IRS problem solvers? Is this your Sometimes I talk with people, I've done a dozen companies, I'm currently principal in five, but every once in a while I meet that rare gem who they're like, yeah, I started one and that's where I'm at.
You know, I started one and that's not the same one where I'm at.
Oh, there you go. Okay.
My first accounting company, you know, I got approval from the large regional firm that I was working with to do individual tax returns sort of on the side, as long as they, you know, weren't in the same ballpark as what we did. And my first accounting company, I called Midas Touch Accounting. So my last name, of course, is Golden. So I think all of my companies, I've always had pretty much some sort of a play on words with my last name, a lot of them anyway. So that was my first one. I just did individual income tax returns for friends and family and people that needed it and, you know, sort of moonlighted. And that's how I started.
Awesome. Okay. So looking back across your career, I'm looking for a hard lesson, something that happened that at the time it happened, it's like, ugh, that hurts. It's painful. I don't like it. Wish it hadn't happened. But maybe today, you know, in retrospect, it was a perfect thing to happen. It just wasn't fun as you were going through it. Do you have a hard lesson you can share?
Absolutely. I think a lot of entrepreneurs have a certain risk tolerance. And my risk tolerance has always been really, really high. I always tell people, you know, I jump off the cliff doing a flying monkey. And I've probably hit and scraped every part of my body against the cliff on the way down, right? So, you know, for me, I decided, yeah, I'm smart. I have an accounting firm, have a tax degree, big man on campus type ideal mindset. I said, I'm going to invest into another company. You know, I really learned from that lesson to stay in my lane. And I used someone else's expertise in order to help leverage my income. And it was a poor decision because I was not the primary and I relied on someone else to get it done. And you know as well as I do, sometimes other people don't have the drive you have, or they don't have the ambition you have, or they don't have the desire for high quality or whatever it may be. But it taught me a great lesson to stay in my lane. Ultimately, I decided to pay that debt back instead of making my house payment and ultimately lost my house. And, you know, my wife, we talked about the whole thing and, you know, we both were in agreement of what we had to do or what I had to do. And so, you know, she stuck with me through the whole thing. And, you know, it's hard to do when you're living in a big, nice house and you've got a 4 and 6 year old and everything's going great. And you make one decision and there goes your house. So we moved from a 4,000 square foot home into a 900 square foot apartment.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing. I appreciate vulnerability and sharing that. You know, the one thing, of course, the title of the show is Proven Entrepreneur Success Stories, but counterintuitively, most all success stories have a failing or two or 17 somewhere along the way. Sure. And the interesting thing is this, sometimes the height of a future success is almost predetermined by the depth of a past failing. And why I see that so often across 36 years of being an entrepreneur, and then of course getting to do these shows and talking with a ton of people. So that's a hard lesson. I think there's another lesson in there for the entrepreneur is this. And there's a defunct construction company out there with a bunch of my money in it that, you know, I don't know where. So it's in a hole in the ground somewhere. But I think it's an entrepreneurial commonality to think that I'm really good at this. And so I'm going to be really good at that too. And, you know, that's not always the case. It is for some people, but for many, it's not. If you're a 5 handicap golfer, it doesn't mean you're going to play hockey well, you know. And it, you know, you might, but you might not. So thanks for sharing that. What about a warp speed moment? So things are going pretty good and you add the right hire, or you implement a new strategy, or an external market event happens, that all of a sudden your growth is just through the moon. Got one of those you can share?
Absolutely. So our company was in the Panhandle, accounting firm, and 2010 hits, BP oil spill, and it greatly affected our area, a lot of the businesses in our area, because of the scare. Oil's going to be washing up on the beaches, and the beaches will never be the same. And there goes the white, beautiful sand, you know, all the worries that everybody had. So 2010-11 was a bad year for a lot of industry, a lot of tourism, a lot of different types of companies during that period. And so I think the smart thing is to be able to realize when you need to shift quickly. And so we shifted into a mode to be able to help people during this time. And so we went from zero to hero in no time flat. So because of that, we were able to help quite a few people, and our bottom line was helped as well, you know?
Yeah. Love that. Zero to hero. Love that. Yeah. Okay. So what about, I'm looking for a nugget, some piece of wisdom in your brain that we want to know. It could be tactical, strategic, experiential, but there's something in there that you know that we want to know. We just don't know what it is to ask you.
So I'm a big fan of operating out of grace and forgiveness. And so what that means to me is, if I ever want grace and forgiveness in my business, and it's just going to be a matter of time before you need it. It's not if you're going to need it, it's going to be a matter of time of when you'll need it. And the same goes with my team. You know, I want to operate out of a place where we're all running at a breakneck speed, arm in arm. And so when someone trips, the two people beside them can hold them up. And, you know, I think the way I run my companies is, if we operate through grace, we operate through forgiveness, our first thought is, how dare you? Our first thought is, what can we learn? Our first thought is, what did we learn? How can we do this better next time? Our first thought is not, I'm going to hit you over the head with a stick because you made a mistake. That's not the way I operate. That's not the way that I like to operate. So, you know, if I operate in place of grace and forgiveness, or a place where, you know, it's not intentional and we want to move forward, that's what the step is. The step is to always move forward. It's not to move backward. It's to, how can I lift that person? How can I lift that client? How can I lift the situation into a place where we can help? You know, in our industry, it's all about adding value. And I've got to add value to clients for them to be able to see my value. And, you know, if I can't add value, I think that one of the things that I have to do is I have to add value through, you know, my outlook and the way that I approach every situation. So I think that my first step is always going to be a place of grace and forgiveness.
I love that. And so I'm convinced that transformative leaders, and there's, you know, leadership has changed, evolved, grown the last 100 years. We've kind of gone from commander at the top and then the second level and third and fourth and all the way down to the troops, to where now in transformative leadership, it's basically inverted to where a great leader casts the vision, recruits the best people on the planet to execute the vision, and then empowers those people to make that execution happen. And if there's a mistake, because the people are all aligned from a value standpoint, it's not really my mistake or your mistake. It's the mistake, and let's fix the problem, not my problem or your problem. Let's fix the problem, and we'll learn and we'll prevent it from happening again. And the most progressive organizations kind of view leadership from that point of view. Okay, going to put you in a time machine here. Okay, just like Star Trek or Star Wars or Star something. And I'm going to take you all the way back. You're probably at the University of Alabama at age 20. And go Tide.
We were really bad then.
Well,
today, we were really bad
then. You've been really, really good for a while. And I'm People a big
forget that.
I'm a big Sooner fan, and so I know what really, really good is, but you got, you know, Saban's got a different level of good than most people. But anyhow, put you in the time machine, take you back to 20-year-old Ben. You get a minute or two to share a couple. You get to grab Ben by the collar and say, listen up, I'm going to give you two or three things here that are going to make things easier, better, faster, smarter for you. What do you tell your 20-year-old self?
Well, if he'll listen. That's the thing. Communication is twofold. One person is talking, one person will actually have to listen. So, you know, I would say continue to go with your gut and trust your instincts and lean on your wife and family more. That it's not all about you. It's about the family, and it's about doing it together, as opposed to thinking that you're all that and you can do it all yourself. Well, you can't. It's okay to trust other people to help you. I would also tell him that learning the value of delegation sooner would help. I used to think that I'll just let them do it and it'll get done the way that I want to. Then it comes to me and I'll be like, oh, well, I don't like the way they do it. But I didn't properly tell the person that did it that they did it, though not really exactly the way I wanted it. So the next time it will come back to me wrong again and I'll be like, oh, they don't know what they're doing. But I think learning the value of delegation is something that I would talk to myself about.
I love that. So I'm a big believer in that you should only, as an entrepreneur, you should only invest your time and energy into activities that are in your zone of genius. And that's different than your zone of excellence or competence. And entrepreneurs many times have a really wide area of excellence. And it's really safe to be there, because you know everything about it. You do it better than almost anybody on the planet. But the problem with your zone of excellence, as opposed to your zone of genius, is in your zone of genius, you actually can be magnificent. You can't get there in your zone of excellence. But your zone of excellence is safer. It's more comfortable. Okay, but the really good stuff exists in your zone of genius. And to do that, you got to delegate. You can't do it all. So I love that. Ben, if one of our listeners or 100 of our listeners had IRS troubles and they wanted to reach out to you, what's the easiest way to get in touch with you?
Definitely go to our website, find out a little bit more about us before you call. I encourage people to find out who they're working with before they work with, if it makes sense for us to work together. Best way to do that is on our website, www.irstroublesolvers.com, and we're more than happy to help you. We have 3 locations, 1 in Seattle, 1 in Chicago, and our headquarters in Alabama.
Awesome. Love that. So sounds like anywhere in the country, if you have IRS troubles and you need IRS trouble solvers, reach out to Ben Golden and his team. Ben, thank you so much. That's today's episode of the Proven Entrepreneur Show. See you next time.
That's today's episode of The Proven Entrepreneur. Go to provenentrepreneurshow.com, subscribe to the show, leave an iTunes review, and you could win a $25,000 VIP day in Dallas with Don himself. And get Don's easier and faster selling with video course free. Please join Don on the next episode of The Proven Entrepreneur.